Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI asks Catholics around the world to join in prayer for the Church in China. A nation on the brink of war and a humanitarian crisis, South Sudan is struggling to build a peaceful future after it became the world's youngest nation last July. And Vatican Radio's film critic speaks about The Hunger Games, which is proving to be a box office success as well as food for thought. Pope Benedict XVI has called on Catholics to join in prayer with the Church in China so that believers of the great nation may become ever more consistent in their witness to the faith. Speaking on Sunday to pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square, the Pope also condemned a bomb attack on a high school in southern Italy and called for prayers for victims of an earthquake that struck the northeastern region of Emilia-Romagna. Emma McCarthy reports.
Despite the threat of rain, St. Peter's Square was thronged with pilgrims and visitors this Sunday, which for many parishes worldwide marks the feast of the Ascension of Our Lord. In his reflections before the Marian prayer, Pope Benedict spoke to all those gathered about the fulfillment of mankind's salvation.
Jesus tells us in the Gospel that he has come so that his joy may be fulfilled in us.
Following the Regina Caeli prayer, Pope Benedict called for our prayers and support for the Church in China.
Giovedì 24 maggio.
Next Thursday, May 24th, is the liturgical memory of Our Lady, Help of Christians, and World Day of Prayer for the Church in China. Pope Benedict called on Catholics there to be faithful to Christ's Church and the successor of Peter, and consistent in their witness to the faith. Finally, and on a more somber note, Pope Benedict prayed for Italy and the victims of two catastrophes that have struck the nation this weekend. One man-made and one a natural calamity. The first was a Saturday morning bomb attack on a Brindisi high school, which the Pope described as a cowardly act of brutal violence. Investigators say that the attack, which killed a teenaged girl and wounded 10 others, was probably carried out by an individual with no links to the mafia, as had been feared at first.
Il mio affettuoso pensiero.
The second catastrophe was a deadly earthquake early Sunday morning in the Emilia region of Italy. Registering magnitude 6 on the Richter scale, it was felt across northern parts of the country, forcing terrified residents into the streets at dawn. Authorities report severe damage, with many collapsed buildings in ancient hilltop towns, and rescuers are still searching for survivors beneath rubble.
Sono spiritualmente vicino.
As he ended his midday appointment in St. Peter's Square, Pope Benedict's last thoughts went to them. He said, "We implore God's mercy for those who have died in the earthquake and relief from suffering for the injured." I'm Emma McCarthy.
Thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report. In the latest development of the simmering conflict between the world's newest nation, South Sudan, and its neighbour, Sudan, Juba is asking the United Nations to impose sanctions on Khartoum. It says that Sudan is failing to obey a Security Council resolution calling for an end to hostilities and renewed negotiations with South Sudan over oil and border disputes. Meanwhile, the UN is warning that more than half the population of South Sudan are facing food shortages due to the continuing conflict. Fighting on the border between the two countries and the shutdown of oil production have had a devastating impact on the South's economy. And analysts say there are fears the situation in the South, which gained independence from Sudan last July, is worsening. I spoke to Father Joseph Callistus, who is based in Juba, but was briefly in Rome to liaise with colleagues here of the Solidarity with South Sudan organization, which has its headquarters very close to the radio. Father Joseph, who is director of the Solidarity with South Sudan project, told me it is a consortium of more than 200 religious congregations involved in capacity building in the new nation.
In 2005, when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed, the Conference of Bishops in Sudan invited a union of major religious superiors, both men and women, sections of eight in Rome, to come and help in rebuilding the new opportunity in South Sudan. And so the union of major religious superiors responded by saying that instead of sending one or two separate religious congregations to work together in capacity building, and chose four areas in which they could help. The areas are the primary school teacher training, health training, in pastoral work with an ongoing formation for laity religious, priests and the church personnel, and then agriculture. These are the four areas that we are involved in, and I am based in Juba as the director of projects at the moment.
Now, you're based in Juba, and we're hearing a lot of news about current events, and just in the middle of April, there seemed to be a huge crisis with some bombardments on the border. What is the situation for the people there at the moment? They were so enthusiastic in July, I remember. Is the impact strong?
The impact of the war is naturally felt throughout the country. What happens during a time of peace is actually people gather themselves and try to rebuild, and this is what the South Sudanese were trying to do since the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005. We could see the development in Juba. Actually, there were no paved roads, and there are many paved roads now, and there were no buildings, and there are many buildings that have come up in the last 4 years, and the people were showing that they are moving into a time of stability, whereas they have lived during the 21 years of war in temporary shelters, where they had to move every now and then out of their own habitat. So the effect of this recent development has brought in naturally a sense of insecurity and instability, and that shows that the prices are going up. The commodities are very scarce, and people are trying to store up things as much as they can. So all sorts of things that come with an unstable situation is happening now in Juba. And so there is a need at the moment also to give the assurance that there is some sort of stability that is there in the presence of the government there.
The Muslim Council appealed to the international community to step in and mediate as it did before the referendum. Do you think this is a good idea?
It is a very important aspect that the international community has to get involved in bringing both Republic of Sudan and Republic of South Sudan to the negotiating table. We know that it is through the mediation of the international community that the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed. And so now it's also an opportunity that unresolved matters of this comprehensive agreement will have to be worked out with the international community present, so that both the Republic of Sudan as well as the Republic of South Sudan can negotiate and come to settle issues like the oil revenue, issues of border demarcation. And these are very important. And the issue of South Sudanese who are living in the north, and these are actually the issues that have not been resolved and that are causing a lot of uncertainty at the moment. And so international community is actually duty-bound to play this role in bringing both the South and the North to the negotiating table so that these issues can be resolved.
You're also mentioning the huge resources that South Sudan does possess, but the need for infrastructure and for investment. And I think the international community has a responsibility in this respect as well.
It has. Actually, the international community has a responsibility towards this. You know, during the time of war, almost all the resources that are in the South were used to develop the Republic of Sudan. And now it is the opportunity that these resources will generate revenue to develop the Republic of South Sudan. And unfortunately, for the last 3 months, the southern government is not able to generate revenue from all these resources that are available in its own land, just because the issues of the oil pipeline is not resolved. So I think international community will have to help this new country to build its infrastructure. And that will happen only when these unresolved issues of border demarcation, oil revenue, the citizenship of the southerners in the north are properly handled. I think it is tied to one another.
You're also mentioning that South Sudan and Sudan see a huge movement as far as displaced people. People are on the move a lot, escaping either a conflict or a border issue or whatever. What is the situation of these people?
Unfortunately, at the moment, there are not only disturbance in the south-north border, but there are also issues that are in South Kordofan, in Nuba Mountains, in Blue Nile, in Darfur. And all these are also creating lots of internally displaced people in the border areas. And as we know, almost all these places are at the border. Now, we know that the situation in South Kordofan is not being spoken as much as the situation in Heglig is spoken. But unfortunately, the recently released report of the Human Rights Watch speaks about the number of children who have been killed, the number of women who have been raped, number of aerial bombardment that are taking place in the South Kordofan area, in Nuba Mountains area. And so there is an issue that needs to be attended to immediately. Now, in the issue of South, Abyei issue became a big issue before the referendum, before the independence of South Sudan, and people of Abyei are still internally displaced in South Sudan, closer to Agok and other places, and hundreds of thousands of people are still living in temporary shelters. Now, Solidarity with South Sudan has recently sent some members to help with the training of teachers in English. We have gone there actually at the invitation of Father Biong, who is a very committed priest of the Diocese of El Obeid, who had stayed with his own people throughout this displacement. And we know that the people need help at this moment. And we know that education is some sort of stability to the people. Even though they are internally displaced, education gives them a sense of stability that their future can be rebuilt on that.
And what about the refugee camps and the emergency aid? Who takes care of that?
Lots of these are being taken care of by many agencies that are operating in south and in the north of both sides of Sudan. We will say that in the south, I know that the Caritas Internationalis is very much present in emergency appeal and as well as helping the people who are internally displaced together with all the other Caritas agencies. I have been with these agencies for meetings, and I know that they have divided themselves to operate in different areas so that the aid is distributed to all the people who are affected by the situation.
You were telling me of the capacity of the South Sudanese people and this moment of opportunity.
As you know, South Sudan has a lot of resources. It's not only about the resources that are available in the country, but I think the commitment of the South Sudanese today to rebuild their new nation. A lot of the people who had gone out of the country during the years of war are returning so that they can contribute towards rebuilding this new nation. And so this resources and this new opportunity that are available come together so that South Sudan can really build itself as a prosperous nation, because it has enough resources to take care of its own affairs, of its own development. And it is only a matter of time. It's a matter of accompaniment and help to put up the infrastructure that this development could take place. And I think actually I know that South Sudan has enough people who are committed, people who are capable, and they have enough resources. It's only a matter of putting these things together to bring the best for the country.
Can you explain to us a little how the bishops are organized in Sudan, the bishops' conference, and also if the state is supporting them?
I have to say that truly these are remarkable spiritual leaders. They have been with the people throughout the war, and they were the strength of the people during the war. And it is also because of their efforts that self-determination was possible for South Sudan. It was actually the bishops who said that we have to put this as part of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And so we have to really admire the commitment of these leaders in the church. Now, South Sudan has 7 dioceses, whereas the North has 2. And after the independence of South Sudan, the conference of bishops decided that there will be one conference operating with 2 secretariats, one in the north and one in the south. There are two dioceses in the north, which is the Diocese of Khartoum, where Cardinal Zubair is the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Khartoum, and in the south, Archdiocese of Juba, where Archbishop Paulino is the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Juba. Now, they are actually very committed people, and as you say, during the synod, they have actively participated in the proceedings, and they are also actively involved in implementing the post-synodal document. Solidarity with South Sudan has held a number of workshops. It is actually in this year, it will have covered almost all the dioceses in the south to disseminate the document that had come out recently, the post-synodal document that came out, calling actually the dioceses to form their pastoral activities with the vision of this post-synodal document, where reconciliation is an important issue, justice and peace is an important issue, intertribal living is an important issue, accountability and transparency is an important issue that this document calls for. So the bishops are committed to what the synod had taught them, and they are also trying to formulate their pastoral program in fulfilling this post-synodal document that came out.
Is the government, the South Sudanese government, supportive of the bishops and of the church's work?
The government of South Sudan respects the church. I have attended many meetings of the Ministry of Education and Ministry of Health as Solidarity with South Sudan is involved in these two areas. And I have heard them saying that mother of education is the church. And so there is a great respect towards the church being the mother of education. And the church is also respected just because church had never left the people. Church was with the people because church is the people. This is what the bishops always say. It's not actually something other than that. It's the people who are the church, and we have been with the people. The government of South Sudan supports the church as much as it can in reaching out to the people, especially to educate them in the areas of education and health. But at the same time, I have to say the church also is the voice. It's the prophetic voice. And the church has always spoken on behalf of the people, calling the government to accountability, calling the government to justice. So the church is also the prophetic voice there. Sometimes it can come into a conflict, but at this moment, I would say the church is the prophetic voice and the government listens to this prophetic voice in South Sudan, and it's a good combination at the moment.
Finally, Father Joseph, you are on your way back as soon as possible. You can't wait to get back. Can you just tell us about your own feelings for South Sudan and your hopes?
My feeling for South Sudan is actually South Sudan has this new opportunity. New opportunity to build itself as the new country that can be a beacon for all the African nations. It has its own resources and committed people who can really build this on the social teachings of the church, so that this country will respect the human right, look for the common good, it will deal with issues of justice, and finally, people could live in peace and prosperity.
Okay, do you have an appeal?
Appeal is actually, you know, just before the referendum took place, Solidarity with South Sudan initiated a prayer campaign called 101 Days of Prayer. And almost when everyone knew that this is not going to happen, 101 Days of Prayer created this opportunity for a new imagination in the people of South Sudan, that people really realized that we need not resolve issues by violence, but we can resolve it by other means. And I think this is again a new opportunity for the international community to support the government of South Sudan to build this new nation. But at the same time, it's an opportunity for the international community to accompany this new nation by prayer. I think people sometimes have never thought that this power of prayer could birth a new nation. And many of the bishops in South Sudan acknowledge that it is because of the power of prayer that this new nation is born. And I suppose all these difficult situations that South Sudan is facing now could be also resolved by the power of prayer. And so it is an invitation for all the listeners to accompany this new nation in prayer.
That was Father Joseph Callistus, Director of Solidarity with South Sudan. And now Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone gives his own opinion on a film that has proven to be a record box office success. The film in question is The Hunger Games, launched as a film for young audiences. I too had read about it, and when I discovered it's about a group of youngsters involved in deadly games with only one survivor, I mentioned to Peter that it didn't really sound like my type of film.
And so it was decreed that each year the 12 districts of Pan Am shall offer up in tribute one young man and woman between the ages of 12 and 18 to be trained in the art of survival and to be prepared to fight to the death.
I didn't think I'd be attracted to it, and I had very little awareness of the novels at all. And when I heard the description of teenagers fighting for survival and eliminating each other, that seemed even less interesting. But when I went to see it, I was caught up with it, and I thought they handled it very well.
We could do it, you know, take off, live in the woods.
They'd catch us.
Well, maybe not.
We wouldn't make it 5 miles.
Let's just tell people who don't know it that it's based on a trilogy of novels by Suzanne Collins, and it's really directed at a young audience.
It is, although I notice each Saturday here in our Melbourne paper, The Age, there's a list of the bestsellers locally and nationwide, and I think for the last 5 weeks, 7 of the 10 positions have been taken by one or other of the trilogy books. It's, to me, amazing, and even last Saturday, the three books and their various versions are on the bestseller list.
Is that because it's such a fierce critique of contemporary society and, of course, of this reality TV which seems to be engulfing us?
So you're here to make me look pretty?
I'm here to help you make an impression.
Well, there's certainly something in that. I think one of the main reasons, at least from the film, that young people, especially girls, are liking it because the leading character is a very strong young woman, still a teenager, but quite a leader, quite a set of values, self-sacrificing, ingenious, all those kinds of things, and interesting for an older audience to watch.
I volunteer as tribute.
And I think younger ones could identify very much with that.
Now, there have been lots of films in the past about imagined future societies, and this is a futuristic film about a dystopian society. You also say the film offers an ironic image of contemporary society. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, the film's set about, I think, 70 years from now. There's been an upheaval, but the powers that be have everybody under control. But one of the ways that they're controlled is by the media and, as you suggested earlier, a love for reality TV. And so there's a certain brainwashing, there's a certain excitement and loyalty, and the ruler, played by Donald Sutherland, has everybody under control, and somehow or other people accept it. And the parallel that they all suggest, of course, is the Roman Empire, where instead of the Colosseum, you've got the reality TV and the Hunger Games.
Welcome, welcome. The time has come to select one courageous young man and woman for the honour of representing District 12 in the 74th annual Hunger Games.
It's kind of a gladiatorial-like fighting in it as well, isn't there?
Well, it is. They go out into the countryside, of course, and have to survive. There are 24 chosen who are considered very privileged to have this particular role, but it still means fighting to the death.
They just want a good show. That's all they want.
There's 24 of us, Gail. Only one comes out.
And from the district where Katniss, the heroine, comes from, there's a young fellow whom she has known in the past, Peter, and to some extent she wants to protect him, although he's a less strong character than she. But there are certainly some very vengeful types. There are some cruel types, generally coming from the upper classes, I might add. And so it is literally some fight to the death.
I just keep wishing I could think of a way to show them that they don't own me. If I'm going to die, I want to still be me.
I just can't afford to think like that.
But not so visually ugly that a younger audience couldn't watch it. And I think parents would probably be a bit reassured that it's not R-rated or anything like that.
Is there a lesson in it for younger audiences? Is there a moral that we say?
Well, I suppose it's the kind of invitation for them to identify with Katniss and look at everything through her eyes. One of the features of the film, in the very satiric tone, is that people do themselves up in all kinds of weird costumes and makeup and a great artificiality in their behaviour. And so the invitation then is to look at these adults who are acting really in a weird kind of manner, and, you know, the critique of society is there.
This is the time to show them everything. Make sure they remember you.
However, there are some characters, one played by Woody Harrelson, who is the coach, who are much more sympathetic. So the adults are not completely overwhelmed by this totalitarian society.
You spoke well of Jennifer Lawrence, who takes the lead role, as you said, but the supporting cast is interesting as well as Woody Harrelson, whom you mentioned, and Donald Sutherland. There are quite a few other well-known figures.
Yes, Elizabeth Banks is a very popular actress. She is one of the more absurd. She's the kind of MC of everything. Mad hats and dresses and artificial manner. Interesting performance. And then Wes Bentley, who came to some prominence in American Beauty a long time ago. He's the organizer, a rather sinister presence as well. But Jennifer Lawrence stands out. I don't know whether you saw her in Winter's Bone. She got an Oscar nomination for that. And she was very good in The Burning Plain with Charlize Theron and Kim Basinger a couple of years ago. So I see on lists, you know, she is certainly going to be in quite a number of films forthcoming. And I don't think she's 20 yet. So obviously a star in the making.
You end your review by saying that although the film can be seen as a standalone story, Donald Sutherland turns to go up a staircase at the end. Obviously, there must be more.
There must be more, yes. And in fact, there are two books more, and there are discussions at the moment. They haven't filmed the second book, but I'd say they're moving towards that, especially with the worldwide success of The Hunger Games. I think it's made $400 million in the United States alone, so obviously a commercial success as well.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
That's all from the English feature programme today and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.